Welcome to Weekly Sedition, the show dedicated to dissent and alternative viewpoints. This is Contra, your host of this and every episode, right here on 97.3 WRIR, Richmond Independent Radio. This is radio for the rest of us. Today we're going to be hearing from some people who literally want to bring down your civilization. As always, it's time to get radical. Coming up right now in Weekly Sedition. The interview I'm about to share with you took place this weekend during the sweltering 100 plus degree heat that has been baking the city over the past weeks. Given the topic of conversation I was about to have, it was terribly appropriate. Richmond hasn't been alone in this, of course. Listen to this little montage that Democracy Now! Opened with yesterday.
The heat wave that's baked the Rockies and the Great Plains now spreading east. There are 113 million Americans now in the excessive heat advisory zone. That's more than a third of the entire U.S. population.
The high today here in Indianapolis, a sizzling 103 degrees. That broke a 78-year-old record.
Nashville broke its all-time record, hitting 109 degrees. Authorities urged people to stay indoors and canceled outdoor events this weekend. From Atlanta,
smoking out here,
to Chicago.
I'm going to bring a towel soaked in ice and a bucket with ice and try to keep cool.
The U.S. National Guard is helping police in Colorado Springs in the wake of the most destructive wildfires in the state's history. Those fires have forced thousands of people to flee their homes.
The fast-moving fires in Colorado have destroyed hundreds of homes and are threatening thousands more. The fires have grown so large, you can see it from space. Take a look at this video from the International Space Station. It shows the area scorched by flames in the western states so far.
It's getting quite dangerous for some people, very old and very young especially. There's an excessive heat watch, which is basically an official way of telling you what we've been telling you for a long time. The rest of this week, lots and lots of excessive heat.
This after the nation saw for the first time in recorded history four tropical storms before July 1st. More disturbingly, and I'd like to stress this one, the International Energy Agency, which recently compiled the most thorough analysis ever of international energy infrastructure, reported that the world is likely to build so many fossil-fueled power stations, energy-guzzling factories, and inefficient buildings in the next 5 years that it will become impossible to hold global warming to safe levels, and the last chance of combating dangerous climate change will be, quote, lost forever. Of course, I'm just talking about weather change here. Environmentalism in general is what I want to talk about today, and that's consumed with issues ranging from GM foods to pesticides to fracking, toxic chemicals found in fetuses and breast milk, and the list goes on and on and on. And if you pay attention to all this, you might just be getting the message that the planet is screwed.
Hi, I'm Val. I'm with Deep Green Resistance.
Hey, I'm Xander. I'm with Deep Green Resistance as well.
Xander and Val aren't the only people in the room with me during this interview. In all, there are five people from Deep Green Resistance in the room, and they all seem to be of the opinion that a grim realization of loss at the state of the world is an appropriate reaction to have.
As an environmental movement that's been around in its modern form really for 50 years, it's been 50 years since Rachel Carson released Silent Spring in 1962, so we're predicating everything that we're saying basically on the fact that as environmentalists we're losing. 150 to 200 species go extinct every day. 90% of the large fish in the ocean are dead. 98% of native forests, 99% of native grasslands. The numbers go on for days.
It will have been impossible at this stage in human history for you to be unfamiliar with environmentalism as a whole or with specific environmental groups and agencies. In fact, you can't go to any store without learning how many things you can buy that are green and eco-friendly. My favorite is Whole Foods, which I have to appreciate for the fact that their Richmond location gives food that's going bad to Food Not Bombs. Nonetheless, it's almost intellectually painful to walk the aisles of a store that bills itself as having some kind of reduced eco-footprint and read packages that try to sell the shopper healthy, fair trade cookies that are individually wrapped in petroleum-based plastics containing pieces of fruit that are shipped via fossil fuels from halfway around the world in a store that's consuming massive quantities of coal-burning electricity to keep specialty desserts frozen. It's what radical environmentalists call greenwashing. Conveniently buy your way to a better world. Feel better about yourself by buying these energy-efficient light bulbs, turn the water off while you're brushing your teeth. Voila, instant environmentalist. This, Val says, is exactly what Deep Green Resistance is not about.
DGR, all of us are coming from the radical side, so we're trying to get to the root of the problem, just like, you know, the word radical comes from that. Looking at the environmental movement, the modern environmental movement as we see it, a lot of the action that's happened has been on the liberal side. So things like individual lifestyle changes or, you know, green consumption, buying green, going green. And our analysis is that those kinds of things aren't enough. We can't buy our way to a cleaner planet. And so we talk about the need for more radical action that really gets to the root of the problem, which we would call civilization. That's the, you know, the thing that we've identified as the enemy here.
Whoa, hello, civilization as the enemy. What does that even mean? Well, it's at this point I should mention the primary ideological founding force of Deep Green Resistance, Derek Jensen. If you've been around the radical community for a while, you've probably heard the name, even if you haven't read one of his many books. And he can tell you exactly what civilization means.
I've defined civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically. Civilization comes from the root civitatis, which means city. And that's true. That's defensible historically, too. That's nice, Derek, but what's a city? Okay, so I've defined a city as
a large group of people living in one place requiring the routine importation of resources. Because if you have a large enough number of people living on a land base that can't support it, you're going to need to get resources from somewhere. And so by extension, you see the emphasis on imperialism, colonialism. You have to be drawing resources from somewhere outside of the heart of empire, because by the time an empire has grown that big, they've completely denuded their landscape at home.
1 hour before this interview, I posted online saying, I'll be interviewing these anti-civilization folks who think that we have to actively dismantle the industrial world. Post questions you'd like me to ask them here, and I'll do it. I thought it'd be good at this point to go over the most common questions, or at least themes, people wanted discussed, and tell you how they were responded to. The most pressing point that people made was that such a destruction of civilization would cause lots of death. Let's be frank, the moment that oil and natural gas infrastructure is gone, the world as we know it ends. Everything we have or do, everything is based on non-renewable resources. But this, says the Deep Green Resistance folks, is exactly why a systemic crash is absolutely inevitable anyway. In fact, this is a core premise of DGR philosophy.
Civilization, our way of life right now, is based on, like I said before, non-renewable resources. So the reality is we're running out of oil. We're running out of these resources that have to be extracted from the earth. So the scary part is that we can't continue living this way. So I think what we're advocating is that we have a choice about how that crash can happen. And we're advocating for communities locally to start learning sustainable ways of living in order to make that crash easier on everyone, and make it more possible for human life and all other life on the planet to exist after civilization runs its course.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources isn't sustainable. When you run out, they're gone. Or any way of living based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources. If there are fewer salmon return every year, eventually you run out. And it doesn't take, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist, like I said, to figure out any of this stuff. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that you can't survive using more energy than comes in from the sun every year. So I ask people all over the country, do you believe that the dominant culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh. And one guy, one of my talks, raised his hand. Everybody looked at him. He said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the next question is, if you don't believe that the dominant culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living, and if you care about your land base, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics?
Jensen tells the story of a woman that hated him so much that she came to multiple talks to tell him so, saying, like the people who responded to my post, that regardless of the fact that our way of life is objectively unsustainable, we can't deindustrialize because then we would be actively taking part in the death of people.
She was upset because I want to deindustrialize, and let's be really honest, deindustrializing is going to kill a lot of people because the entire industrial agriculture system is based on natural gas and oil. And if you take down the natural gas and oil infrastructure, well, the people in the third, the rural people in the third world, I think, will be much better off immediately. Rural people in the United States will be okay. Urban people, I mean, like the rich people in cities in the United States, I don't care because they're a problem anyway. It's an interesting question. And I mean, the truth is every cell of my body wants for there to be a voluntary transformation, wants for us to sort of ease off, or them to ease off, or whatever, and for there to be this soft landing, and for people to suddenly get smart about population and consumption and all that, but it ain't gonna happen. Okay, so on one hand, if you actively work to bring stuff down, there's a lot of people who are gonna suffer, die. If you don't actively work to bring stuff down, it's gonna come down eventually, and then there's gonna be a lot of people, a lot more people die. So it's like, what the hell do you do? I get to like page 400, I can't go on because of this woman's question, which she raises a good point. And then finally I came up with an answer. If you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about them Red Sox? We probably also agree that this crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with all this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization is going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All of this can look like supporting traditional, local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who have chosen that work. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so f***ed up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love. Do what you can. Do what best serves your land base. We need it all.
Another big question people had was about medicine. I posed this question to these folks by noting that I recently contracted Lyme disease from a tick bite, and that thanks to modern medical advances, I merely took an inexpensive antibiotic for a few days and it was gone. I also noted that pre-industrial lifespans were about half what they are today for this reason. Their first response was that aside from the traditional and herbal antibiotics that pre-industrial cultures employed, that we're kind of speaking from an incredibly privileged point of view when we speak like first world people in this regard. They note that most of the world, in terms of population, has little or no access to these life-saving technologies. I mean, the UN says that 18,000 children starve to death every day. That's just the kids. So they say the perpetuation of this destruction of the entire planet so that the privileged few can have toothpaste and penicillin is a bad argument on multiple levels.
Also, what comes to mind for me is the amount of diseases and health risks and dangers that are a direct result of civilization and of those practices. I appreciate you bringing up Lyme disease, but I got MRSA a couple of years ago. Like, MRSA only exists because of the same types of antibiotics that are curing some things. They're also creating, you know, superbugs that they can't cure because we've, you know, caused them to evolve in this way. That's only one example. We can also look at the amount of toxins in not only our rivers but our breast milk. We can always also look at the fact that tooth decay largely happens because of the foods of civilization that didn't exist before industrial agriculture. So I think that it's definitely very valid to think of the, you know, the risk of not having some of these medical technologies, but I think that they come with a price too, and that's something that we also can't ignore.
What Jensen and Deep Green Resistance really want to know is, what would it take for you to actively dismantle civilization? What would industrial society have to do that it hasn't done already to make you actively fight against it?
If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Well, yeah, we'd vote. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we then do if they instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males between the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist, or following Mussolini, corporate, party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because, hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies? If fascists systematically deforested the planet, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forest, and from there to the boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them their marching orders? I mean, what would we do if a bunch of aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically vacuum the oceans? What would we do if space aliens, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to put dioxin in every mother's breast milk, flame retardant in every mother's breast milk, if they started to melt the ice cap, and I don't know if you saw this article in the New York Times the other day talking about the benefits of melting the polar ice cap. Okay, so what would we all do if they did this? I think we would all put on our camel outfits, grab our AK-47s, head off to the... Wrong audience. Am I the only person here with an AK-47? How many people in this room have had someone, how many of you have had someone that you love die of cancer? That's what, 60, 70%, 80% maybe? Cancer is, of course, caused by the toxification of the entire environment in great measure. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens in the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues? Or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can or won't give that threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are.
As you can see, we've come quite far from green shopping at the grocery store at this point.
To start with, the idea of being able to buy our way to a cleaner planet is completely outside of the realm of possibility, because what's killing our planet is the tendency towards commodifying everything around us. Capitalism is the latest and most insidious form of civilized organization that I think the planet has ever seen. And so in order to address that, we have to address the deeper root of the problem, which is the structures of power maintaining this civilized way of life that is at this point really wholly defined by industrial capitalism. So what Deep Green Resistance is advocating is a two-pronged strategy, both an underground and an above-ground section of a resistance movement. So Deep Green Resistance is the above-ground portion of that. We are advocating a strategy that really addresses the root of the problem, and we are also working to build just, sustainable communities that are integrated with their local land bases to vocalize support for an underground that is going to be necessary at this stage in the game.
The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I'll say it again. It's pretty obvious. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. Any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. I can guarantee that 50 years from now, there will be people sitting along the banks of the Columbia River. Well, they'll be glowing, for one thing, and they will be saying, I am starving to death because you didn't take out the dams that were killing the salmon. And the dams that were killing the salmon were there to provide electricity so that corporations could smelt aluminum for cheap beer cans. It's like, damn you.
So our strategy is broken down into four parts. So there are four phases. And keep in mind that this is a very broad strategy that is meant to be tailored to individual situations and individual locations, as well as the people that are taking up those individual local fights. So those four phases are networking and mobilization is the first one. The second one is sabotage and asymmetrical warfare. The third one is systems disruption, and the fourth one is all-out dismantling of industrial infrastructure. And there's more about that on our website. I don't think we really have time to go into all of them now. But essentially, it is something that is split up. Both an above-ground portion and an underground portion can address those phases. And so it's a building process.
One of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and they co-opted hope. And the way they did that was by making it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather move to a ghetto, reserve, reservation? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather get on a cattle car? Would you rather resist, possibly get killed? You want to go in and take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed? But I'll tell you something very interesting. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Remember that over the next 10 years. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason that she stayed with him was because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. I mean, does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody really think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? False hopes. False hopes.
That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening to Weekly Sedition and for listening to 97.3 WRIR. It's Richmond Independent Radio. Radio for the rest of us. Stay tuned.
Poison in my oxygen.